Droa.
Droa.
Seki.
Seki.
Nebaim.
Nebaim.
Droa.
Droa.
Seki.
Seki.
Nebaim.
Nebaim.
Okay, this is a line from the third chapter of the Abhidhamma. Okay, we're back to Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma Kosha. Bye. Okay. And today I wanted to talk a little bit about two ideas in the third chapter. One is the idea of sustenance, what keeps your body going. And the other one is general description of our planet. Okay? We don't have time to go through the whole third chapter, which is really beautiful. Someday you should. And I'm just going to be able to go through a short amount in a couple hours. So first we're going to go through the kinds of sustenance. Okay? Droa means, do you guys know Droa? Droa? Droa means beings. Okay? Literally those who go. Okay?
Go?
Living beings, yeah. Droa means to go.
Oh.
Going ones, creatures. Droa. Se means sustenance. Se means sustenance. Seki means by sustenance. By, B-Y. Nebayin means they stay or they live. In other words, living beings remain here. They continue to live because of sustenance. Sustenance keeps people alive. Right? I guess if you want to put it in plain English. It's always kind of nice. There are four famous kinds of se. Four kinds of sustenance. Say, kamgi se.
Kamgi se.
Kamgi se.
Kamgi se.
Okay. What's kam, do you know? Kam's this place out in East Tibet, right? I mean, kam means a district sometimes. Kam also is the Tibetan word for datu, like Dharma Datu is true to kam. And in that case, datu means one of the 18 divisions of existence. This kam is spelled differently, but it's the same meaning. It means portion, like a portion. In other words, kam gise, which means portionable sustenance, means anything you ingest by taking in portion. So the kind of food that we eat, the physical food, is kam gise, because we bite it into portions and then swallow it. Okay? That's kam gise. You need some kamgi se, someone? You can help me. So kamgi se means any kind of food that you ingest, like we do in portions, generally. Okay. There's a subtle kind and a rough kind. Or you can say subtle and gross, how's that? For subtle, they give, first of all, the food that Bardoas eat. Remember Bardoas?
Smell.
Yeah, who said smell? That's right. So Bardoas, they can live off smells. Smells also have to be chopped into sniffs to be ingested. Seriously, okay? Then the food of desire around pleasure beings, and the food of, what was the other one? Humans of the first eon. The first humans to come to this planet. These two kinds of beings, these last two, they eat a thing called, say dutsi. Dutsi means nectar or ambrosia or something like that. Okay? Sometimes it's translated as amrta in Sanskrit, meaning the nectar of immortality. This is not anything that good, okay? There are different dutsis. Some of you heard of other kind of dutsis. This is similar, same name, different stuff. Humans of the first eon, and there's a Garden of Eden story in the third chapter of the Abhidhamma. You know that the humans who first come to this planet, first of all, the first ones here are the bodies are made of light. There's no sun or moon. They just see their way around by shining, and it's a beautiful story. It's really an extraordinary story. I don't think we're going to get to it, but basically, when the day comes that they have to eat, they just the ground is made of some kind of clay or some kind of goo, and when they're hungry, they just take a finger full and lick it, and they can just scoop it off. It's the dirt of the earth is edible, And they just live off that. You know, and they just pick it up and eat it. And that's all they need to live on. And that's dutsi. That's what humans are the first neon. I mean, I'm not going to go through it tonight. It's not part of class. But then there's this story of the fall, you know. I forget how it is. Oh, and crops come up by themselves. And then somebody decides, and then in the morning everybody goes to get their crops, you know, and they collect their crops. And then one day somebody says, I'm tired of getting up every morning to collect my crops. I'll just take double, and then I'll sleep in tomorrow, you know. So he takes double, and somebody starts to store possessions, you know. Somebody starts to say, I can have twice as much. You know, and then somebody else says, well, I might as well store 3 days' worth. So, you know, somebody else starts. And then it starts, you can guess, trouble. Then people build the first house because they want to no one to see what they're doing. And then, like that. And then things get worse and worse and worse until millions of years later there's a... I don't know, because of their desire, people start, their bodies start to harden and get, like, flesh instead of light. And then, in those days, people live for 80,000 years, and people lifespans start to degenerate. And then we're supposed to be near the end. And near the end, people will blow themselves up with some weapon that destroys the whole earth in fire, or things like that. It's very interesting. That's in all in the third chapter. I'm not out of time for it tonight. You can read it when you learn Tibetan. These are sometimes called subtle because. Sometimes called subtle because they don't produce any poo-poo or pee-pee, okay? They say that the food sinks into the body like melted butter poured on sand. And it's digested by just, what is it? It's absorbed by the body. And there's no excrement or anything. Just dissolves into the body. It keeps the body alive. And then they say gross food is all the other kinds, which is what we live on. So you could say human beings. The kind of food that we have. In the scripture it says, you know, the kind of food that we eat. Boy, everybody's sick tonight. We need some say. What was the other thing? They say that kangise consists of a combination of three physical objects. They say that kangise is a combination of these three. Tastes, smells, and tangibles. When you eat something, it smells, it tastes, and it touches you. Kangise doesn't exist outside of the desire realm. Why? Yeah, the whole point is you would get to the other realms by losing your desire for desire realm objects. And food is one of the grossest ones. So the whole point of, you can get to the form realm and the formless realm, even in meditation, only if you don't have desire for these things. You know, they don't eat this kind of food. They don't have this kind of food there. They have no desire for physical food. In fact, in the form realm, there is no smell or taste. They have no desire for food. There's no reason for smells or taste to be there.
What do you have a need for, but no desire for it?
They don't even need it. And we'll get to that. Okay. They live off something else. Okay, that's just about food number one. Say rekpa.
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 Rekpa means contact. And in this case, it means the convening of three things. Especially in the Wheel of Life, when they say link number six is called rekpa also. But this is where the object, meaning, let's say, some nice looking food, and the sense power, which is your eye, the sense organ which is located in the back of the eyeball, and then the consciousness, the awareness of the food, seeing the food, the awareness of seeing the food. That's contact. Those three bumping into each other, those three happening at the same time, is called rekpa, or contact. What it basically means is, when you catch sight of some good-looking food, you know, and you're hungry, it can bring you some kind of joy, and that joy can also sustain you for a while. you know? Like, nobody dies 3 feet from a big meal. Nobody ever did, you know? I mean, if there was a big meal right there and you were starving and you're only 2 feet away, something keeps you going the last 2 feet, you know? Seriously. No horse ever died a foot from water. You know, it's just something keeps them going. And it may not be physical. There may be no physical food or water left in them that could sustain them, but it's the mind. The mind is sustaining them. And that's where hope, for example, can sustain you. And they give a lot of examples of that. They give examples in scripture of people who, they give an example of a father who had two sons, and I think it was the father or the sons, I don't remember, but somebody wraps up a bag full of dust and tells everybody that this is a bag full of flour. And as long as they believe that it's flour, they stay alive. And then one day they open it up and see dust, and they die on the spot. You know, or you see, oftentimes you see spouses die within a short time of their other spouse. It's something to do with the loss of hope or something like that. Doctor comes and tells you, well, it's terminal, and then suddenly the person dies. This is where hope has kept the person alive. So that's a kind of repa. They say in that sense, visible objects can also sustain you. They don't sustain you themselves, but it's the joy that you have by looking at the thing. It's the joy which is part of the repa, which is keeping you alive. Say Semba.
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 I think you know Semba now. Oh, Friday night's doing that, Semba. Now you got everything. Sem, you know, means what? Chitta. Mind. Okay, Sempa is something totally different. Sempa is any movement of the mind, directing of the mind. When you guys studied karma, if you remember, this is the essence of karma. This is mental karma. Anytime your mind shifts, that's sempa. How many sempas?
64.
Something like that. 64 can go on in a finger snap. Okay, not many sempas can go on in a finger snap. It's basically the mind moving, the mind being directed to a new object, on its way to a new object. I've seen, you know, this is not explained clearly in the Abhidhamma literature, why this is a kind of food. Somebody says it's because, for example, this would always be linked with hope. As you hope, your mind is moving. And they say, therefore, it's a kind of sustenance. Because then they go through proving that hope can keep you alive. But about 3 minutes ago on the computer, I saw another one. I kind of like that one. And I see it alluded to in other Abhidhamma literature. And that's that... This particular Semba is what sustains a new rebirth. Semba is the food that sustains a new rebirth. In other words, what the main thing that causes your next life is what? It's karma. And the essence of karma, the karma behind all karmas, is Semba. It's the movement of the mind. The movement of the mind instigates you to do actions of body and speech, which are the karma that we are most familiar with. But the one behind it, and the essence of all karma, is Semba. That's the second line of the fourth chapter, Deni Semba Dande Che. Semba is the essence of karma. So this is food in the sense that it sustains your next life. It's your next life is feeding off the karmas that your mind is collecting now.
Yeah. When your mind isn't working, I mean, is it moving? Is it after death?
Always, your mind never stops moving.
So, but it doesn't sustain you then?
It sustains the bardo and the next life. Okay, it's the same karma. Okay. It's one projecting karma, which is why the bardo being looks like the being that you're going to be. Because they're both projected by the same karma. Okay, that's number three. And then the fourth one is...
What kind of being takes the second version? Is there some sort of being that takes, you know, the contact that they use?
We all of us. These last three kinds of food are contained in all three realms. All three realms have the last three kinds of food. Only the desire realm has the first kind of food. In other words, formless realm beings can have Rekpa and Semba and Namche for food to keep them alive. Say Namche. Namche means consciousness itself, awareness itself, consciousness. It's the general state of awareness that we all have. It gets very much, it never stops. It can be put to a low level like by a Mike Tyson punch, okay? But we never say you become unconscious. Your consciousness is always going. It may be reduced to a low level by a good punch, but it's still going, you're still alive. And the explanation, the best explanation I've seen of why Namche, general awareness, is a kind of food, is that it also keeps you alive, and it's also partly what keeps you alive in your next life, because by being here now and giving Semba a place to work, it contributes to your next life. But that's all I've seen. That's all I've seen. That somehow it contributes to being as being the basis of Semba. Semba is a mental function. Namche is a general mind itself, and they're always different. Your general awareness and all the sometimes they say 52 mental functions or 51. Those are specific functions of your mind. But your general awareness is where they reside. They reside together. They stay together. They are linked together. If you're going to talk about food, I think it's good to talk about. There's another kind of food mentioned in the first chapter of the Abhidharma, the second chapter. And I think it's important to mention that. It's not on your homework or anything. You should still write it. So don't confuse these with the four kinds of sustenance. These are something different. Say, gebe gyushi.
Gebe gyushi.
Gebe gyushi.
Gebe gyushi.
Gepa means to flourish. Okay, flourish. Something like that. Flourish. Gyu means cause, and shi means form. And what it means is that there are four kinds of things that cause your body to be healthy, or cause your body to, what do you call that? I don't know.
Thrive?
Nourish, they nourish your body, okay? They nourish your body. And in Abhidharma system, in all Buddhism, when I say nourish your body, it means two things. It means nourishes the physical foundations for your senses, which means the faculty of your eye, the faculty of your tongue, the cells that reside on your tongue that allow you to taste, the cells that reside in the back of your eyeball, according to Abhidharma, that allow you to see, the cells that reside in the ear that allow you to hear, the cells that reside around the front of the nose here that allow you to smell. And these four things help those, they nourish those sense powers. They're called sense powers. And in particular, they sustain the four elements which are behind those sense powers. Those four elements, the sense powers are composed of four different energies. And in fact, a lot of Tibetan medicine is how to affect those four energies. And that's Sachu Menlo. That's Sa is earth, Chu is wind, Me is fire, Lung is wind. Sa is earth, Chu is water, Me is fire, Lung is wind. And they don't believe that there's little pieces of fire in your nose or something like that. These are just names for common things in the world like wind, which refer to specific types of energy which resemble them. They're metaphorical names. They are symbolic names. They don't believe that there's a little electric fan in your body making wind, you know. But there's an energy in your body whose function resembles the function of the wind outside. And those are the four elements. They are the foundational energy behind your sense powers. They underlie your sense powers. And these four these four things that I'm going to mention now, they nourish those elements. They keep those elements going well. And thereby keep your organs going well and therefore keep you alive. Okay? They nourish you. But specifically by affecting those four elements, meaning those four fundamental energies which are behind all physical matter. And I'll go through those now. First one is...
What does it mean for the four elements to flourish?
I'll give you an example. Like if the element of heat were to be damaged or diminished in any significant way, then the element of water would assert itself more strongly, and the person in question would catch a cold. Say kase.
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 Kase means food. Okay. When you connect the word ka, which means mouth, to the word se, which means sustenance, that's food. That's what we, you know, that's a McDonald's hamburger. It's kase. That's food. That's the first of the four causes which make your physical faculties and their and the elements that underlie them flourish, or they sustain them, they nourish them. Okay. So food is one. Food is the first one. Say lekja.
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 Generally, lekja means doing good, okay, good things. So you know, if you don't study any commentaries, you think it's like doing good deeds. But we've input like 6 or 7 great Abhidharma commentaries, and you can search it in a few minutes, and you can see, if you can read it, that examples are given. I can think of 3 or 4 examples in the scriptures for this lecture. The first one is kunye. Say kunye?
Kunye.
Which is sometimes mispronounced kumye, and that's a kind of massage. It's a kind of system of massage that came from ancient India. System of massaging the body. That's one. So lekja, you see, doesn't mean good deeds in this case. It means physical ways of treating the body which are pleasant to the, you know, they sustain, they help the body. The other is taking a nice bath, nice warm bath, medicinal bath, you know, like any kind of nice bath. Another one is rubbing certain ointments on your body. Those are examples of lekja. And they actually help the elements in your body, and they sustain, they help nourish your body. I know we had a masseuse, famous masseuse, come in. We tried to get Rinpoche to agree to it one day, and he finally agreed, and we thought it would help his bones, you know. And he said he felt 10 years younger for about 2 days after that. And that's lekja.
Michael, could you say that's just generally taking care of your body, or are these specific things only?
I think you could say generally taking care of your body. Anything that takes care of your body, exercise, I guess, would be lekja, I would guess. In one scripture, I've seen lekja included in the subtle form of kambise. You know, included with smells for a bardo being, nectar for, you know, humans of the first eon, and then they say massage and other kinds of lekja are included as subtle forms, because they don't create what? Yeah, they don't create eskimen, okay. You know, I mean, they sustain your body, but they don't create that kind. They're sort of a kind of a pure food, a subtle food.
Where does light come?
There's a big debate in the Abhidharma about light. You mean this kind of light?
Like sunlight.
Yeah, there's a big debate about it. And some people, the Abhidharma goes to great lengths to prove that it's not physical, it's not the vision of light. It's either the happiness produced from seeing beautiful light that acts as rekpa, and therefore is a kind of food for human beings, or it could be the tangible feeling of the warmth on the body. They have a big debate about it. They decide that it's not the color and the shape. It's the enjoyment. And they say that certain parts of us, our body and mind, can live off feelings of joy as a kind of nourishment. And that would be sempa or rekpa. Those are kinds of That's where joy actually sustains your body, makes you feel physically better. So there is a scriptural basis for that, that if you're happy, your body will actually be functioning better. I mean, it's something that's not very clear. I mean, somebody has to study these things more carefully. I don't think anyone's really going into it. It'd be nice if somebody did. You know. I don't think anyone's ever gone into the Abhidharma looking for these things, studying them. Say ni.
Ni.
Ni. Ni. Ni means sleep. And that also nourishes your body. And it puts those physical elements into proper order. Keeps them running smoothly. You need a certain amount of ni. Can't overdo it, but shouldn't underdo it. Right?
Yeah.
Unless you love it and it gives you pleasure.
I misspelled something here, sorry. Say Dingin Zin.
Dingin Zin.
Dingin Zin.
Dingin Zin.
Somebody said meditation. Yeah. Concentration. Concentration is also a kind of sustenance. Good for your body. If you meditate regularly, like say an hour a day, I mean, first, most importantly, by far, you can see emptiness if you get used to that. But even in a worldly sense, it sustains, it could make you healthier. Just not having your mind torn in many different places is a kind of healthy thing for a human being. And the definition of Dingin Zin is what? Do you know? Semtse Chikpa. That's the literal meaning of dingin. Dingin Zen means vivid. But what's the definition? Semtse Chikpa.
Focused on one object.
Yeah, one-pointed mind, single-pointedness. And I always used to wonder what single-pointed mind was. You know, like, if I had I have kind of a peaked head, you know, does that mean I have single-pointedness? And I used to wonder. And the scriptures, I finally saw the scripture that really made me happy, because it says, single-pointed mind means focusing on one object. That's all it means. It's just sticking to, it's one-pointedness. What do you call it in English? There's something else. There's one, single-mindedness, where you're focused on one thing at a time. You know, and personally, I don't know about you, but if I have a bad day at work, or I'm overwhelmed with too many things to do, and my mind is on many objects, it actually physically affects me. Maybe stress comes from that. I don't know. Maybe physical stress comes from a lack of this kind of nourishment. Maybe that's possible, that you know, people who get nervous or physically who start to have physical problems because of stress, maybe it's because they don't have enough of this nourishment. You know, so those are all four, and you need all four, some form of those. I think of my boss, you know, his concentration powers are extraordinary. And he doesn't have to eat much at all. I mean, you see monks in the monastery who don't eat almost at all, but they have some kind of extraordinary thing in them. And they are healthy. I mean, their bodies are strong and they're not, they're really healthy and strong. And they're not eating practically anything. That's from Dingin Zin. So those are Gyebigyushi, and I just thought it was interesting. For me, it's very interesting. I never had time to explore it. Somebody should explore it. But those are the four kinds of food, and I think it's good to know those and take care of them. What is the function of food? It keeps you alive, and then the scriptures always say, here in samsara. In other words, these are not ultimate remedies. These are just to keep your dirty, fallible, degenerating body going for a while. You know, but basically all of the things I've listed up here, the four kinds of sustenance and the four kinds of the four things that are good for the elements of your body, and the scriptures are careful to point out that these are just sustaining an entity which is by nature defective, and which you will lose, and which will get sick, and which will kill you. So don't get hung up in them. You know, you meet Buddhists who are, they're more like nature freaks or something like that. I mean, they're not really looking for the ultimate goals of Buddhism. They're looking to feel good, to feel better because they meditate, or to, you know, something like that. That's not a goal. These are all sakche. Sakche in Abhidharma means polluted or polluted. And they are polluted and they will kill you. They're all just temporary ways to stay alive while you get out of here. Okay. So I think it's important not to get hung up on these things as a goal in themselves. You have to use them wisely and like snakes, you know, poisonous snakes. If you get too close to them and get too wrapped up in what you're eating and all that thing, then it's very damaging, it's very dangerous. You know? Eat well, live in a healthy way, take care of yourself, but it's not a goal, your body's going to die anyway. Just keep it healthy while you use it to reach nirvana and Buddhahood. Andy's not here, right? Andy's bringing the homework.
Whoever arranged that so nicely for us.
Who paid off Andy? Say, Jigden?
Jigden.
I think the Sanskrit is loka. This is actually the name of the third chapter of the Abhidharma Kosha, and it means the world. The world. Jig means perishable, destructible. And Den means the foundation that we live on. So really the very word for the world in Tibetan and in Sanskrit is emphasizing the fact that it's going to die. It's perishable. It's in the word for the world is that. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the Abhidharma describes the world starting. And then the early eons of the world. It's just kind of interesting, and then we'll talk about if it has any relevance to Buddhism. Say Lungi.
Lungi.
Kimkor.
Kimkor.
Lungi.
Lungi.
Kimkor.
Kimkor.
According to the third chapter of the Abhidharma, there are two great presentations of how the world came to be. One is in the Kala Chakra system of Tantra. And one is in the Abhidharma. We're going to do the Abhidharma one. And according to the Abhidharma, at the very beginning of time, no beginning of time, but anyway, beginning of this planet, space was just empty. It was just empty space. And then they say there's this energy called Lung. Lung means what?
Wind.
Wind. Okay, it's the energy called wind. They don't believe that there was some big fan, you know, blowing emptiness. but there was this energy called wind. And it started to cycle in very gently, like wafting. And then they say it picks up speed and it picks up velocity until it starts to congeal into a mass. And after a while, the element of wind is moving at such velocity that it becomes as hard as a diamond. And so that's the basis of the world. It's supposed to be this big disc. Kinkor means disc. Do you know the Sanskrit word? Close. And this is one of the only places where you see the word mandala used in its real meaning, which is disc. It's a disc. It's a huge disc. So mandala, when you offer a mandala, Om Vajrabhumi Ahum Vajrasekhisa Shi, you're offering these fundamental discs. Okay. And the Sanskrit word in the Abhidharma at this point is mandala. That part
is the space where the earth was to be acute, or was it the space everywhere?
Never was, because there have been planets forever.
So this empty space refers to the place for the earth.
The Abhidharma says at this point, you couldn't describe all the planets in the universe, even the inhabited ones. And it goes through the number of inhabited ones. And it says, you know, how many galaxies there are and what universes they're in and where the beings are. But on this point, it says, let's just talk about the one that's... And it's interesting, they define this planet by being the one that is related to the paradise where Shakyamuni Buddha is living right now. It's interesting. They define this planet, you know, they don't say third planet from the sun or something. they say the planet which is connected to the paradise, which I'm not even sure is. We have to talk about that someday. But anyway, everything at the beginning is empty, and then there's this big disc of wind.
Or empty, traditional Buddhist empty, or void of.
Not emptiness at all. Mm-hmm. No way. I mean, not philosophical emptiness, but physically empty. Okay. Then on top of that, for certain people.
Meaning when it becomes a diamond?
Yeah, after that's already hard. Okay. Yeah. It's still just a big vortex of wind, but it's circling at such velocity that you couldn't break it with a diamond. If you smashed a diamond onto it, nothing would happen. It's not exactly true, but anyway.
Why did you give us this name? I'm sorry, I didn't get it. Dispendala Lombi.
This is the translation of Tinkor. Tinkor is Tibetan.
Yeah.
And the Sanskrit word here is mandala. And mandala. So when you offer a mandala, what are you offering? I mean, you're starting with that disc. That's why you start with a plate. By the way, I'll give you the dimensions of the disc of wind. All right. It's measured in yojanas. Okay. Yojana, if you work it out, you can work it out different ways. But there are so many domes to a yojana. There are so many truths to a dome. And there's so many source to a true, and there's so many, it goes on and on. But I'm saying if you say that a source is an inch, okay, like a knuckle, then there's so many source to a true, and there's four truths to a, and then a shudom, and then there's so many domes to a bhakti, and like that. You can go on and on. And it goes down to sub-microscopic particles. It goes down like 32 levels into subatomic particles. Then it goes up to light years. But just talking in our realm, okay, a bhakti or a yojana, you can figure it out, I guess it's about 4.5 miles. According to that, this disk is about 7 million miles wide in diameter. No, sorry, 7 million miles thick.
7 million miles wide, thick.
Thick. This is 7 million miles.
Oh, so it's a disc like that?
It's not, because the width is...
Wow.
That many miles.
Wow.
So, I mean, if I really drew it on here, you couldn't see the thickness. I mean, I'd have to use New York City, and then maybe you can see the thickness. I don't know. But this is the, yeah.
Is this disk the basis of our planet or the cosmos?
No, our planet. Well, it gets into it a little bit troublesome. We'll see. It gets to be a bit of a question. You can call it all our world. How's that? Okay. And you'll see why. And then on top of that, I'll get you the measurements of the pole. On top of this is I haven't done this in 20 years, so it's hard to. I once figured it all out when I had time for these things. This is a disc of water and gold. The inner part is gold, and that's the gold disc. And then there's a disc of water on top of that. So the gold disc is contained in the water disc, and that's about 5 million miles thick. Okay.
So, wind?
Yeah, here's this wind disk.
Yeah.
Then there's this huge rain, this huge sort of a rainstorm, okay? Anyway, water collects on top of the disk of wind. Some kind of primeval water. Okay.
And is that Serki?
Serki Kingor is a disk of gold that forms here in the disk of water.
Within?
Yeah, they seem to be connected. They seem
within
to be
connected. Or
seems to be part of the disk of water, like maybe the lower third, I think it is.
Lower third?
Something like that.
It sank to the bottom.
Sank to the bottom. Okay, here we go. A great wind stirs up the water, and the disk of water is only 3.6 wide after that, and then the disk of gold is 1.4 million miles wide. Okay, so here's the disk of wind, and then after some cosmic event, this disk of gold forms, and then on top of that is the disk of water. Okay, make sense? So this whole thing is 5 million miles wide, and after this cosmic event, the lower third of the water, 1.4 million miles, has turned to gold. And above that is water, 3.6 million miles wide. And below the whole thing is 7 million miles of wind.
Is it real gold or
is it real gold? Pure gold. Maybe we could find it. This is only 5.4 million miles wide, so I guess if you really put it on top of the wind disk, it would look like that. You know? I mean, the wind disk is like a galaxy holding up. Some people say it's the that spinning vortex. It's like a cyclone, and it's keeping the water in. And then other people say it's just the karma of the beings who live on that planet is keeping the water there. But basically, you have to imagine that when you're offering a mandala, you know, Om Vajabhumi Ahum. Om Vajabhumi Ahum means the diamond floor, I guess referring to the wind. Om Vajabhumi Ahum. One just said the sashi, and then you start building it up. And when you offer a mandala, this is what you're offering. You are actually offering the world. And you have to understand that when you offer a mandala. Each part of the mandala has a symbolic meaning. And we could have a whole class on that. But basically, when you're doing that mandala offering, you're offering the Abhidharma presentation of the world. It's like, I guess we would walk in with a globe and offer down or something. You know? So you've got the disk of wind, the disk of gold, and disk of water. Then it goes into the mountains of the world. And in the center is...
Where are we?
We didn't get there yet. The chart is always ahead of me. Okay. Then there's a mountain called... And I haven't done this for 20 years, so I don't remember anything. But anyway, this is Mount Meru.
It's on top of
the... It's on top of the... It's coming out of the water. Coming out of the water is Mount Meru. This is the great central mountain of the world. I think it's four. I don't remember. But it's shaped like that. I remember. I worked that out. You can read it in the reading. And by the way, the reading is all that the Abhidharma says. So, on top of that are, around that are six mountain ranges. I don't have room for them. But anyway, it's six mountain ranges.
Is Mount Meru supposed to have four stories, or?
I think it's four, but I can't swear to it. I figured it out one time. You can figure it out yourself. It's all good. Or you can read one of the other commentaries. His auto commentary, Vasubandhu's auto commentary, has a lot of it. I've seen actually some pictures of mandalas which are correct, and they have, you know, Mount Meru. It does have steps, it does have terraces, and on the terraces live different kinds of beings. And the tops of the terraces are wider than the base of the terraces, like that. And then there's one mountain range going around here, around the whole outside. These seven mountain ranges are made of gold, supposedly, and the one around the edge is made of iron. I think it's one. Plus seven, plus one. So nine galactic mountain ranges.
So there's six ranges.
Did I say six?
Yeah.
You're right, six. Eight great mountain ranges altogether.
Six and one is seven.
Huh? Plus the mountain.
One, six, and one. Count Mount Meru is one. Six mountain ranges concentrically circling it, and then one great range out at the edge. Now, what's between here and the edge, we'll get into later, okay?
Sumeru
is made of the following elements, okay? And there's a debate about it. But anyway, the eastern side is supposed to be silver. Where's the east? According to most ways, you should do it this way. Eastern side silver. Southern side is lapis, which is what color?
Blue.
Yeah. West side is ruby, and the north side is gold.
But these are real things?
We gotta talk about it, okay?
We just call out.
I mean, it's good to know. Well, I'll tell you why. Anyway, we'll get into that before the end of tonight.
Where are these directions if there is still no sun? South, east, north, and...
That's a good question. Anyway, we'll get into it. I think the directions are, if you ask me, I mean, my own guess would be they're defined by... well, it's a long story. But anyway, the sun moves around... I mean, I didn't want to get into the astrology. The sun moves around Mount Meru like this. Okay? Chased by the moon. Right. And it's a long story. And the sun comes over Earth, and then goes over the other continent. But I'll get into it, okay? Don't get ahead of me. All right. The color of the sky in each of the four directions from Mount Meru is determined by the color of the side of Mount Meru. The color of the very sky around Mount Meru is determined by the element on that quarter of Mount Meru. So if the sky was blue, where would you be living?
Lapis.
Oh, south side.
Lapis blue? Is that the blue?
No. Then this one, this mountain is, let's see, Mount Supreme, 360,000 miles down into the water, 360,000 miles above the water. 720,000 miles high. And then each of these mountain ranges decreases by half, out to the edge.
And you said those mountains were gold and the outer one was iron?
Yeah.
How much did they decrease by?
Half. Okay. Between each mountain range is an ocean.
I can't draw that.
Yeah, I know. Okay. It's a long story. I mean, we'll go through it if you want. I think I got a mountain left out, but I'll check it while during the break. I think there's nine. I think there's seven here, but I gotta check it. I'll check the text. Okay. These are called the inner oceans, and then out here is the outer ocean. Between this mountain range out here and the beginning of the inner ranges. So this ocean is huge. And it measures, they say, 1.5 million miles.
That's between the outer and the inner mountains, yeah. And the last of the inner range mountains.
Let me check. I believe it's between this iron mountain and the last golden mountain. Now there are four great continents in that ocean. And tradition would say that you should start counting from the south, which would be here, in my excellent drawing. In the outer ocean, in that big outer ocean, there are four continents. Maybe I better blow this up. So you got Mount Meru or something, and then you got all these mountain ranges, and then you have there's a continent out here. It's 2,000 yojana on each side. I'm not sure it's facing that way, but anyway, its shape is supposed to be like that, almost a triangle. 2,000 times 4.5 is what? 9,000 miles. To a side. This is the southern continent, And it's called Zambu. Zambu Lim.
South.
Yeah, if you count, I'm counting that as south. Which is tradition. I mean, you count, you normally count east towards yourself. So, to the south is Zambu Lim. Why is it called Zambu Lim? Ling means island. The Sanskrit is dvipa. Pa means water. And dvi means divide. And that's a pun in Sanskrit. Dvipa means the thing that divides water, which is an island. Or a continent. Zambu is the sound that a tree, a fruit falling from the zambu tree makes when it hits the water. Zambu. So if you ever wondered where the name of your planet came from, we live on Zambu Lim. This is where we live.
Michael, this is a triangle. I know it's a sphere.
It's, well, they say three sides are 2,000 yojana, which is about 9,000 miles. And the fourth side is 3.5. It's 2,000, 2,000, 2,000, 2,000, and then the tip is only 3.5.
Yeah, but I mean, how do you put the shape with the shape that they do?
Say again?
Is this a triangle, you said?
Right? No, it's not. It's shaped like a wagon. What's a wagon shape? Not in India. You got one bullock, and the two sticks come up, and they come to a point right over the bull. So, shaped like, it is four-sided, but the fourth side is this big, and the other three sides are this big. Okay? Okay. Got it?
Yeah.
All right. You okay?
Where's the world?
This whole thing is the world. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it. We supposedly we live here.
That's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to picture that. And
here's me. Okay. Now we go east. It's supposed to be like a half moon. And I don't know the orientation, but roughly like that. This is called Great Body, Lupakpo. And there's a continent in the back there.
Can you write it down?
Yeah. There's one in the back called Bawangtu. Yeah, that's west. If you really drew them, it would be like pinheads on the Pacific Ocean. You know, small. Compared to the circumference of the ocean. So when you do your mandala offering, what do you say? Om Vajrabhumi Ahum. Here's the diamond floor. Om Vajrareti Ahum. Here's the great fence of iron. Om Vajrachichariko Yikikoi Usu Rigyapo Rira. In the middle is Mount Meru. Sha Lupapo. To the east of Lupapo. Ho Zapumi. Lupa Lamchu, Changa Mindin, Luda Lupak, Nayatam Layashin, Yongan Nam Nam Chodro, Jaminyan Nam Jaminyan Gida. Okay? Each continent has two subcontinents, arranged like that. And when you're doing your mandala offering, you're supposed to be putting the rice there like that. So you go, Ho Zamulin, Nu Balanchu, Changa Mindin, Nu. Okay?
Okay.
We have to learn it someday. But basically, that's what you're doing when you do all that mishmash with the.
And why are you doing mandala, right?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, you have to imagine when you do it, the whole planet. I mean, you can visualize planet Earth, okay? Because that's what you're used to. And the whole planet. Like, I tend to think of all the jewelry shops in Hong Kong, you know? And, no, it means, you know, all the wheat in Kansas, all the flowers and, you know, I mean,
but
you're just...
Why do you have to visualize?
You're visualizing the entire planet and offering it to your Lama. You know, you're asking for a Dharma class. You couldn't pay for this class. I had people accuse me of charging for class, you know? And me and Rinpoche were joking about the other night, you know, what could I charge you for a class? You know, what is nirvana worth? How do you put a price on that? You know, it's priceless. It's absolutely, totally priceless. I mean, for one class, you're supposed to offer the whole planet. You know, for 2 hours of this kind of a class, you're supposed to offer the planet. You know, so what good is like $10 or $20? You know, I mean, it's more valuable than all the money in America to be in this class for 2 hours. You know, you can't pay for it, and it's crazy to charge anybody. You know, people are asking me, you should charge. We're losing money. You know, and it just feels funny. It feels ridiculous because what do you pay for the removal of your mental afflictions? You know, how many people should I charge per hour? You know. What's it worth you? There's your jealousy. You know.
You can scale the price.
Which you can only do by seeing emptiness. You know, which you can only do by seeing emptiness. Someone has to teach you to do it. That's very precious. You know, you can't pay for that. And no one can teach you otherwise. So anyway, what you're doing at the beginning of class is offering the universe. Or, you know, the known universe, okay? You're offering the whole world. Incidentally, if you study mandala offering carefully, each object that you offer after that, the precious minister, the precious wheel, the precious vase, they all have meaning. They all represent some spiritual quality. And you have to study it someday. But basically, when you do your mandala offering now, you know why you're sticking four piles of grain, and then two on each four, and then like that, you know. This is what you're doing. After, we'll take a break, but after that, I'm going to talk about why the hell does this matter to us, you know. I mean, what's the use of standing up here? I don't know any Buddhist teacher in America who goes through this whole thing, you know. And I know the Dalai Lama takes great pains to avoid it, usually. Because it just sounds silly, and we had a lot of giggling during the thing, and we'll talk about it. So take a break.
Seven?
Yeah, there are seven concentric mountain ranges. And then 1/8, that if you count Meru's one, and then the concentric ranges are seven, and then the what we call the encircling range is nine. So, I mean, so that's nine total. Nine total mountain ranges. Mount Meru one, seven rings around that, then a huge ocean. And then finally another mountain.
What's beyond this mountain? It's the end of the universe. This one, right? Or there is no
end of the earth.
What's that?
Beyond the Iron Mountain range, that's the end of the universe. Of this one universe.
I think you would hit the disk of wind, right?
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. Okay. I gotta clarify one thing. The seven oceans between here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, those are called the seas of sport.
Sport?
Sport, meaning having a good time.
Sport?
Yeah. I mean, in the sense of having a sporting, okay, having a good time. And the first of the seas of sport here is called the inner sea. So really it's just the, I guess it's the ocean between Mount Meru and the first ring that's called the inner sea. And then the rest of these are, they're all seas of sport, but the innermost one is called the inner ocean. And this is called the great outer ocean. The one between the last mountain range and then the circling range on the edge. Let me see if I... Then I put in, there's a part of a reading about various characteristics of bumbling of our world. Now, where are we? I mean, this whole thing would be considered like one world. This whole thing, and then there's hells going down, we'll talk about that later. But that whole construct is considered one planet. And there are small galaxies made of 1,000 of these. There are larger galaxies made of 1,000,000 of these, and then there are major galaxies made of 1,000,000,000 of these. And then there are many of those in the universe. What's the point? Now, why go through all these things? And why talk about such an obviously primitive perception of the world. Okay? Yeah. There's lots of ways to talk about them. I mean, there's many, many ways to talk about them. But, I mean, I have this pet peeve, you know, of apologizing for Vasubandhu, you know. Vasubandhu, in his fifth and sixth chapters, for example, outlines what's going on in the 15 milliseconds after the path of seeing. I mean, after seeing emptiness directly. This guy was not a fool. Okay? I mean, he saw extraordinary things. He had extraordinary vision. I mean, translating the Abhidharma is like an aborigine studying an atom bomb, you know? I mean, you have that feeling when you're trying to translate it. It's like you're trying to divide between 20 different levels of something you have not the slightest imagination of what it's like. And then you're wondering about this person who wrote it, you know, like he's describing things that he's very familiar with, you know, spiritually. These levels and things that to him are quite natural, you know. He's got like, I don't know, 37 kinds of concentration, you know, 47 kinds of selflessness and all these things. And all you can do is translate the words because there's no way you could ever imagine what he's talking about. So why has he got a chapter about, you know, a world that you could fall off the edge of? And then I think there's like three great explanations. I mean, one, people say, oh, Mount Meru is like Mount Everest, and to the south is India, this big plain that's kind of triangular, and probably, I don't know, Russia is coming in. And, you know, that's one popular approach, you know. The other one is that he didn't believe in it, he knew it wasn't that way, but he was talking to readers who thought it was that way, so he had to present it that way. That's another approach. But there's a third possibility, which people don't talk about, and I think, you know, it has to do with emptiness. And we talked about the guy at work that you don't like. I mean, people who've been here for a while know that example. And there's this person at work, and I gave the example all the time, sorry to bore you older people, but, you know, my boss, this happened Friday or Thursday, she burst into the room, there's about 14 people in the room, we're in this long room with diamonds on each side and people sitting there, you know, and she bursts into the door and she says to me, you know, why the hell isn't this order finished or something like that, you're screaming at me, these diamonds aren't ready, you know. This is why I work, because it's so good for my Buddhism. And she's screaming at me, and she's got a face in my face, and she's asking me why I couldn't do this impossible thing anyway. And to me at that moment, she looks very bad. You know, she looks very ugly and very bad. But in the same room, there are people, you know, everyone turns, you know, to their right. And they look at me, and some people are upset because they like me and they don't like her, and they see her as being very bad. And then some people probably don't like me very much, and they're thinking, well, finally, this guy who doesn't show up here very much and who's on the phone all the time with his students is finally getting what he deserves for not finishing the day. You know? So they're actually having a pleasant experience. And then there's all these neutral people who just immediately turn back to their work because they don't care either way. The point is that what is the nature of her being bad or good? You know, bad and good are opposite qualities. They cannot adhere to one object at one time. Impossible. I mean, just logically impossible. So she cannot be what she appears to be. Right? I mean, that's obvious. She cannot be good and bad at the same time. Impossible. And it's being bad and being good cannot be qualities of her. Because if they were, she would blow up or something. Because they're just opposite qualities. They cannot adhere to one object at the same time. They're like all blue and all red. They cannot be qualities of one object at the same time. Impossible. So what's going on? You know, where is the bad and good coming from? If she does not have them as a quality of hers, because if she did, she'd be good and bad at the same time, which is impossible. So what's going on?
Your self-perception?
It's my projection. Okay. It's, perception is one thing. You know, I'm in a bad mood and people look bad. That's one thing. But my brain is forcing me to see her a certain way. That's a different thing. I call it projection, say. You know, but what is she really?
She's blank.
She's blank. I like the word blank. I prefer blank to the word emptiness. She's blank. She's blank. She doesn't have those qualities. Is there a woman in front of me with a red face?
Yeah.
There is. Okay. But I'm the one who's seeing her as anger, as seeing her as bad. Because the other people see the red face and think what? Righteous. He finally got caught. This guy doesn't do any work all day. You know, finally he got caught. You know, it's great. Our boss is a great boss. She's finally understood what's going on. So there's some. No. But the two perceptions of the bosses being righteous and good, and the bosses being ugly and mean and unfair, those are opposite qualities. So they cannot be qualities of one object at the same time. It's impossible. She's blank. And I'm perceiving it one way. I'm projecting onto her one way. And other people are projecting onto her another way. Does that mean that tomorrow, when I go to work, and she's going to come in and ask me about the D7 pricing table that I didn't finish, okay? And she's going to yell at me. And does that mean that I can choose to project on her? I'll just choose to project her as a nice boss today. I mean, when she yells at me, I'll decide that it's pleasant. Can you do that? Cannot. Can you? Does that mean you cannot choose your projection on her? You can't. You don't. So where's it coming from if not willpower? Yeah, if we studied karma, it takes a long time to learn it. But basically, in my mind stream, there are certain seeds. They are ripening, and they are forcing me to see her as bad. Okay. Is she bad? She is bad. Is it valid? Is it valid? What we call karma. Is it valid? Yes, it's valid. All the conditions are there, and I'm seeing a bad person. And she can fire me. And I won't have enough money to support this place. This can happen, you know? I mean, it would happen. That's functional. It functions. It's an illusion, but it functions. You know, it is my projection, and I am creating it, in a sense, from my past karma. But it works, and it can kill you. It can fire you. It can make your ears burn. You know, I mean, it's functional. It's not what we thought it was, but it still works. And that's what Nagarjuna keeps saying over and over again. Tsongkhapa keeps saying over and over again, yeah, it's artificial. It's your projection. But it works. And in fact, if it weren't your projection, it couldn't work. If she was bad out there on her own, from her side, if she was good out there from her own on her side, then everyone would perceive it the same way. But they don't. Which proves it's coming from somewhere else. If she was bad from her side, she could never change. What's changing when she gets better is what?
Your projection.
My projections. She's not changing.
You can't choose in any situation.
Not at all. I mean, if you decide that you would like to be more calm in those situations and try to think of your enemy as your friend, as the Dalai Lama is always saying, that helps. I mean, that's a psychological projection. I'm talking about a reality projection. There's a big difference. Okay? There's a big difference between recognizing this being as an enemy and trying to think of them as a friend because they're teaching you something, and just them never being your enemy because you don't have a projection to think of them as an enemy. There's a big difference between those two. One is like a psychological decision to, okay, I'll try to remember how this pain in the ass is somehow helping me, you know. And the other one is that you never meet the pain in the butt. They just don't exist because you don't have the karma to see them. So what does that tell you about the planet? And that's very important. I mean, I think Vasubandhu put that in there for a reason.
We're just dealing with our projections of
planet. Where's the planet come from?
Well, we don't have.
Why is the planet round to a satellite picture?
Collective karma. Collective karma.
It's a collective karma. I mean, we all have the karma to see a picture. I had Indians in Babanagar, India, swearing to. They have a Jain museum dedicated to proving that the world is not round. And it's pretty interesting.
To convince you.
But the point is this. I mean, when you see it, look at a satellite picture, and you see the world as something spherical, that's no more valid than this. I mean, the Vasubandhu is trying to tell us something. He's not just some crazy guy who finishes this incredible chapter on the psychology of the human mind and then is moving into a chapter on the subtleties of karma. And in between there, he sticks this stupid thing about the water falling off the side of earth and things like that, you know. It's not like that. I mean, don't think that. It'd be a bad deed, I think. He's trying to tell us something about our perceptions. And there's nothing to say that dare to guess that in 100 years from now people will call us stupid. They say, oh, they looked at those satellite pictures and thought the world was round, you know, spherical. But we know different, you know. It's really a projection based on your mind. And if you had, boy, that they didn't know how to keep their morality and their bodhisattva vows and their tantric vows, because if they had, they'd see the world like we see it, which is really the way it is, you know. I mean, they'll call us primitive, you know. The enlightened beings of the future will say, all those poor people back in 1995, all they could see of the world was this round thing with oceans on it and mountains and stuff. You know, they had no idea that it was a paradise, that it was a Buddha realm. You know, poor them, they couldn't keep their tantric vows or bodhisattva vows, you know. So they got stuck seeing these satellite pictures, you know. There will be beings like that. And they'll say that about us. And it applies even to objects in your own world now. You know, if you do your practices well, if you take your bodhisattva vows, and particularly if you take a tantric initiation, and you keep it and you do like 8 or 9 strict tantric retreats in the right way, your perception of things won't be at all what it is now. If it is, then something's wrong. You know, I mean, there's got to be a difference between us not having done those things and someone like 5 years after they've done those things, that their perceptions of the world are totally different. Of the same planet that you're looking at. And they're not seeing that primitive thing called a satellite picture. You know, they're not seeing a big flat piece of gold with water hanging off the top. You know, they're seeing something totally different. So I think Vasubandhu is pulling our legs or something. He's trying to say, come on, you know, don't you get the point? You know, this is a projection. The way you think the planet is also a primitive projection. And if you were more advanced, not in the sense of computers and circuitry, but if you were more advanced spiritually, in the sense of having done your tantric retreats and kept your vows and done your tantric practices, you wouldn't be seeing the world like this at all. Because the world's not like that. So that's the point. That's actually why we're having a class about the world. All right? Now, the person who has your homework papers is in Brooklyn. Which is somewhere east of Manhattan.
In his perception.
So I'm going to write the questions for you. I'm sorry. They went on a mission yesterday and didn't come back. This is homework six. By the way, I wouldn't mind if you... I'm actually think the four causes of, what do you call it, flourishing are more interesting. But I'll leave it up to you. Yet you probably half the people will put one and half the people put the other. But you know there's two sets of four. So if you want an A+, put both of them. Here you could say, you know, what is their function overall? And then what is their function... I don't want to answer it for you, but what is their function towards the source of your body?
Would you accept a schematic drawing for 4 and 5?
Yeah, I think so. Here are your old homeworks.
What's the meditation?
Can you hear this now? Can I talk? Oh, the meditation is... got cut off. I'd say that, yeah, meditate on your perception of the world. I would say what's the most important is, and I think it was what got cut off, was that whether or not your perception is the only one possible. You know, like a logical meditation on that. And I think, you know, that involves what we just talked about. And it's maybe the most important thing in the class. Why is your perception? Is your perception the only one possible? Why or why not? Okay, we'll do a prayer and then you guys can.
Whether or not you can stick around the world, which is the only one valid. It's the only valid one. Thank you.
Okay, you gotta offer this planet now, okay?
Sajj.